Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Derek Paulson is Associate Dean of the College of Justice and Safety here at Eastern Kentucky University, and we wanted to get his thoughts on the calls for police reform now being heard in protest demonstrations across the country, sparked by the recent deaths at the hands of police of George Floyd in Minneapolis and Breonna Taylor and David McAtee in Louisville. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Paulson.
Thank you for having me.
And your focus at EKU is on the education of police officers versus their training. Can you tell us what is the difference?
So the College of Justice Safety has multiple programs that deal with education in general. So we have quite a few different degrees that deal with fire safety. We have emergency medicine. We have occupational safety. And we also have criminal justice, police studies, and corrections as well. And that's all housed in the Stratton building. And the building next door to us is where the Department of Criminal Justice Training has their facility, and they do recruit training. So the vast majority of police agencies in the state of Kentucky send their new recruits to the Department of Criminal Justice Training to receive their basic training, for the most part, to become a police officer. That's where you learn all sorts of things, including using a gun, pursuit driving, those sorts of things. You learn all of the things you need to become a police officer. Whereas we in Stratton in the College of Justice and Safety really focus on the education, which gives you a broader understanding from a police standpoint. It can be things such as the role of police in society or the history of police, as well as broader themes about criminal justice and the criminal justice system. Really, that's kind of a hallmark of our College of Justice Safety, is that critical thinking and kind of a broader understanding of the role of a public safety agency within the realm of society. And hopefully we'll be able to have some conversations about it as we come back in the fall about, you know, are there things that we need to be focusing on from an education standpoint that may be beneficial to policing in general. And I think that kind of discussion would also be good to have kind of at the policing level. You know, what is it about, should education be more focused on rather than just training?
First, I want to acknowledge that policing is hard work, and be clear
Absolutely.
About that. And there are plenty of bad guys out there who need to be apprehended and face their days in court and prison if necessary. But some police, not all, but some also have been known to disperse young people from street corners without a legal basis, to conduct searches without probable cause, in some cases take enforcement action based on inaccurate knowledge of the law. And I'm wondering if education provides officers with the knowledge of the laws that they are tasked with enforcing.
It can. From a very basic level, we have criminal law classes, we have criminal procedure classes, not always required as part of our core, but there is a broader understanding that we do in our, you know, like our foundations of policing and our intro to criminal justice and those kinds of classes that really gets students understanding, if not specifically how to do policing, but we really talk about, you know, what it is to be a police officer and kind of the good parts of it, how it should be part of the community. And I think that's one of those aspects that education can provide that not necessarily you always get through training, where you're focused more on tactics. There is a lot of training that's done at Department of Criminal Justice Training that gets to higher level things where you start getting into leadership issues. But from our perspective, we're not necessarily providing those skills on leadership, but we are providing that understanding of how does a police officer fit within the realm of society, within a city, within a larger organization, and what is it that constitutes bad policing and good policing. I think we provide a lot of discussion about that, kind of a critical look at the role of police in society and how police have done things in the past that, you know, you just simply don't get in a training situation. Policing doesn't require, for the most part, a college education, but I think that college education can be very beneficial to those that go into policing.
In light of the movement calling for the reform of policing in many cities and towns happening across the country, are you there at EKU looking at your curriculum for any possible changes or updating?
We have already started talking about that. In fact, that's one of those things that we were actually talking about that previously. It's one of those things that faculty often discuss, you know, how do we look at, you know, our curriculum, does it need updating? But I think when it comes to our police studies degree, that's one that we've kind of been looking at as some of our enrollments have gone down. Is there something that we could do to update what we offer and how we can look at it? That's a faculty-led discussion that I'm hoping we'll be able to get more into this fall as faculty come back. But we've already had, or I've had conversations where I've had people reach out from the Justice Cabinet where we've had discussions about what kinds of things do they see that their officers are lacking. Where are there areas that we can assist in terms of providing education about administration, about, you know, again, getting back to this multicultural societies and how police fit into those areas and how diversity can be more of a thing that we focus on in terms of our education. But also just trying to figure out, again, if we've got officers that are not required to have an education, how do we make it more attractive to them? And I think on part of that is going to have to come from policing itself so that there's an incentive for them to go back and get an education and that they see at an organizational level a benefit in getting an education, that there is a benefit to being a better police officer. There is a benefit to being able to move up in an organization, you know, up to sergeant, lieutenants, et cetera, up the ladder, that education can help them provide, again, those critical thinking skills, touching on things that you'll never talk about in a training necessarily, to give them a more well-rounded view of the role of how police fit into the daily functions of a society. And again, how that's changed. And I think that's a big thing as well. I know policing has been around for a long time, but the duties of police and what they do now and how they go about doing it has changed dramatically, you know, in the last 100 and 120 years. And it's constantly evolving. We're seeing that happen now as well. Even before the calls for reforms, policing was constantly changing. So I think that's one of the things that we need to look at is with all that's going on right now, how do we look at what we're offering? And, you know, does it need to change? And if so, how will we go about doing that?
The Lexington Police Department stands out in my mind as a police department. It is highly educated. Tell us about that.
I agree with you there. And I give all the kudos to the various chiefs that have been there, going back to Anthony Beatty and then Ronnie Bastin, Mark Barnard, and current with Chief Weathers. It first started with, you know, a program actually with the Department of Criminal Justice Training where there was a way for officers to go and get part of what we call the school strategic leadership, where they got credits and we worked with them to say, hey, why don't you guys go on and finish up and get a master's degree? And the chiefs really felt there was a real benefit that officers receive by going and getting, again, not just having an undergraduate degree, but getting a master's degree that focused on higher level things that started to get into leadership issues and management issues and also very different ways of, you know, like what is the impact of for an officer and understanding the role of the media in shaping the narrative on crime and how people look at police and how people look at criminals and who they assign criminals, you know, who they consider criminals. But the chiefs there have consistently not just said, we're going to support this financially, which they have in terms of giving a stipend to officers for those classes, but also really reinforcing that belief in education by using it as a hiring consideration in terms of those that want to move up, such that right now, formally or informally, it has been for years now that if you want to move up in the ranks, having a master's is one of those things that will benefit you greatly. And I completely applaud them on it. I think it's really served them well, because it's given them a different perspective on the community that they serve. And Lexington is the second largest city in the state and has a very unique population in some ways, a very large university, healthcare. We've got some different things than maybe some other communities do. And the police, I think, have done a good job of trying to get out in front of those issues. And I do attribute quite a bit of that to just, you know, things that they have learned from us and getting a different way of going about what they do. I think that's really one of those values of education as opposed to just training. Training is great and is necessary. And honestly, our training academy in the state of Kentucky is probably one of the best in the entire country. But that education and thinking about things in a more critical way, in a different way, is also beneficial to the leadership and of policing, and not just leadership, but all the way down towards sergeants, lieutenants, et cetera.
Well, emanating out of the protest demonstrations that have been occurring in recent weeks have been calls for the defunding, quote unquote, of police departments. And we do hear from many who believe the term is somewhat misleading, that what is really needed is a restructuring of police departments and maybe a reallocation of funds away from militarization and toward assisting improved social services, such as domestic and mental health issues, that would relieve police of doing some things that they weren't trained to do and don't want to do to begin with. Where are you on this?
policing has accumulated quite a few jobs that they may not necessarily have the training for and may not have necessarily all the skills for. And that runs the gamut. But I think mental health issues are a prime area, and homelessness issues. When I was in Lexington working for the city there, those were two very big issues that are interrelated. And add those duties on top of everything else that police are doing, and it's difficult. There's a phrase that I used to always say that if you're not sure who to call about an issue, you call the police. And they are often the first to respond, and to their own admission, may not be the right people to respond, but they're there. And I think there are a lot of, quite a few areas, really, that could be better served, both for the police and for the community, if we had others to be able to respond either with or instead of the police. And, I, you know, Lexington, again, did work on some of those things in terms of homelessness, particularly where we have a large homeless population. And they really worked to create a homeless coordinator and put a, you know, some serious money behind it and to work with the police when they went out to those issues. And they did some formal and informal training on how to respond to those issues, and realizing that it's not going to be solved by the police. It's going to be solved by other things such as housing and services. And that's really whether or not the money came from a police budget to go into that. I don't believe it did. I think it was more additional money rather than supplanting. But I think it was a great way for Lexington to start looking at it, realizing that you're not going to police your way out of a homelessness problem. And that's probably quite a few other areas where we could say the same thing. You're not going to police your way out of these issues. And so learning to address them more at their root causes and trying to find different ways to go about that is important for any community. In terms of where that money comes from is going to be even more important now with reduced state and local budgets because of the pandemic and the associated economic crisis that's going along with it. But I think you'll find quite a few police officers at all ranks that would say, we would love to not have to deal with those issues because we don't know how to deal with them very well. And I think the community would feel the same way. They might come at it differently, but I think they both agree that they're not best suited to handle numerous issues that they're currently dealing with because people don't know who else to call. And so the police are called and they're dispatched, and then it leads to more problems.
We're talking with Derek Paulson, Associate Dean of the College of Justice and Safety here at EKU. And Dr. Paulson, paramilitary SWAT units are increasingly being used to respond to protest activity. And there are these independent training companies that serve both military and police clients, and they emphasize military-style approaches or a warrior mentality. And do you think, can we attribute to this some of the behavior that we witnessed in responses to recent protest demonstrations?
I'm sure it has a role to play in it, but I can say this. The vast majority are not probably getting training from those types of companies. They may get, you know, one person might go out and do it, and there's a lot more that goes into it. But, you know, sometimes it's the lack of training that also leads to this. I think what you'll see is that a lot of communities don't necessarily get a lot of training on how to respond to riots. Some communities do, for better or for worse. Lexington is one that has dealt with some riots, largely because of the University of Kentucky basketball. But a lot of other communities around the country don't have that training. And when you're dealing with a lot of other issues, you may not have gone through it. You know, you might have had it at basic training. You may have had one continuing education since then, and you don't really know how to respond. Now, that's part of it. But I will say militarism does run through police culture. There are a lot of things that are very similar in the training. And the SWAT teams are seen as that pinnacle in many police agencies of what real policing is. You know, it's probably not the best use. A SWAT team has got a very specific specialized uses originally created for responding to kind of hostage situations in a limited way. But there probably needs to be a much better discussion about how we dial back militarism and policing. Going in a different direction when police agencies have gone that way for a very long time is going to take some time. And finding ways to train and educate officers to respond in a different way is going to take some time as well. And I'm sure we'll have some communities that will be better at it than others.
Do you think that Lexington, Richmond, and other cities in Kentucky, for that matter, should, if they haven't already, consider forming citizens' commissions to provide oversight to police departments? Or is that viewed as unwelcome Monday morning quarterbacking?
I don't know if I want to go so far as to say that a citizens' review is definitely the right way to go. But I will say this. Having more citizen input is important in policing. And I think sometimes it may be good for a review board, but you may only have input then when there is an issue that needs reviewing, as opposed to continuous input. And I think that may be more important for communities and police agencies, is to have a more ongoing discussion about how the community wants to be policed and how that looks, rather than waiting for a situation where it may be a police disciplinary and there's some sort of thing that falls under that veil of review. So, you know, while I think it's important and can be used well, I also think that in some cases the current system may work. I'm really not sure. That's not my area, but I will say this. I do think there needs to be more police community interaction about how policing takes place in a community. And there's only one way to do that, and that's at the local level. And I think that there just has to be a much more open line of communication, not just police saying, hey, this is what happened, but just needs to be more free flowing. And the police need to, it's going to be uncomfortable for them, but I think being more willing to listen and take comments and listen to them would benefit them greatly, and might help deal with some of the issues that these communities are dealing with right now.
Dr. Derek Paulson is Associate Dean of the College of Justice and Safety here at Eastern Kentucky University. We thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Governor Andy Beshear recently rolled out guidelines on how Kentucky schools can reopen in the age of COVID-19. The guidance leaves many big decisions up to local school districts, including start date and whether to use digital instruction. But as Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman reminds us, masks will be mandatory for students if schools can't keep them 6 feet apart.
It is our duty to protect every child, but it is also our duty to protect every adult and every family member of the folks in those school buildings.
And each student will undergo a daily temperature check when they enter the building. Kevin Brown, Kentucky's interim commissioner of education, says there is no doubt this is going to be a big lift for schools.
Those recommendations are not easy to implement. They will not be. But they are certainly necessary.
Kentucky has nearly 650,000 children attending preschool through high schools in 172 school districts. 42,000 teachers and 54,000 administrators and support staff are working in the 1,466 public schools across the state. Added together, 17% of the state's population, that's almost one-fifth, attend or work for public schools in Kentucky. Many of the issues facing public schools, teachers, students, and their families are national trends: funding, student performance, issues related to diversity, and school safety. Other issues are unique to Kentucky, such as high rates of poverty, lack of internet access and technology in schools and the homes of students, or funding for transportation. Public education sometimes looks very different in Kentucky. And now, a pandemic. In this new series, hosted by Cynthia Reeser, Professor of Social Studies Education, and Tanya May, Director of Research and Recruitment in the College of Education here at EKU, are looking into the many challenges of reopening Kentucky public schools with no end in sight to the COVID-19 pandemic. Cynthia Reeser has spoken with teachers from rural schools across the WEKU listening area about their experiences since public schools closed on Friday, March 13th.
I'm here today with Micah Fons, and Micah is a special education teacher for 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders at Mount Sterling Elementary in the Montgomery County Public School System. And we're going to talk about her experience after schools closed on Friday, March 13th. So, Micah, Friday, March 13th, that was the last day that our public school students attended classes in Kentucky. And at first, teachers thought, oh, we're just going to be closed a few weeks. So tell us about that last day at school with your students.
Okay, wow. Yes, thinking back to March 13th, Friday the 13th, it was a very chaotic day. We knew what was coming, you know, that we knew that we were going to be out. So we were definitely preparing the work for students. And as a special education teacher, I was really busy trying to make modifications for all of my students based on their accommodations that they receive. So in our minds, we thought we'd be back just in a couple of weeks. And so the kids, there was definitely some excitement in the air with the kids. They thought, you know, oh, we're going to get a little bit of a break, not realizing it was going to be the rest of the year. At one time, we had thought we were going to be out for 5 days, and then kind of at the very last minute, we knew we were trying to prepare for 10 days. So, like I said, it was very, very chaotic that last day for teachers, trying to focus on the work and not so much on the kids, which I do regret a whole lot looking back on that. Thinking about the kids, like I said, they were excited, and they were, you know, telling us, you know, I love you, I'll see you in a couple of weeks, and trying to give hugs. And even though I did give hugs. It was kind of half-heartedly because I had this focus on getting this workout, and that was kind of my priority that day. So looking back on that day, I wish that I had taken a little more time to kind of be in the moment and focus more on the kids and less on the work, knowing what I know now, that I would not see all my kids for the rest of the year.
That would be hard. So you mentioned typically special education teachers adapt the assignments for their students, their special needs students. So these can be learning disabilities or health challenges, ADHD, behavior issues, and other disabilities. So that's tough in a normal setting. How did distance learning make your job even more challenging? And how did you overcome that?
Okay, well, yes, you're right. It's a major challenge. So having that 10-day packet of work, that's how we kind of sent those out in packets. We had that ahead of time, and so we were working on accommodating our students and providing modifications to that work. But like you said, every packet might look different because every kid's needs, you know, are different. So we kind of did that. That was what we were working on that last day and getting that out to our students. And then after those 10 days, we call it, in Montgomery County, we call it tribe days. So after those 10 tribe days were over and we realized we were going to, you know, keep on doing the long distance learning, our district worked more toward doing choice boards for the work for our students. So a lot of my kids were able to choose work that met their needs. So maybe it might have just been, you know, find anything in your home that you can read and then summarize to someone in your family, you know, at home. So they were able to choose the things that worked for them based on the assignments that we were giving them. I did have some kids, though, that were just having trouble getting motivated at home. Also, they didn't have a lot of support at home. They had parents that may be working a couple of fast food jobs because, you know, drive-thrus were still open and very busy. So they didn't have that support at home with somebody helping them. So after talking to several parents, I decided to implement what I called porch sessions. So for several of my students the parents were willing and able to let me do this, I actually showed up at their house. We kept, you know, the 6 feet of distance between us. I called them porch sessions because the first student that I was able to go to, I brought my camping chair, I sat on her porch, and she had a screen door that we were able to have our distance, and she worked from the inside and I worked from the outside, and we kind of worked through her math and her reading assignments because this was a student who she does have some behavior issues happening, and she was just having a lot of trouble focusing on getting her work done at home, and her parent was just pretty much at wit's end. So this was a great way for us to meet her needs and to help her get, you know, what she needed to get done, and it was very successful. I started going actually twice a week to her house, and then I had several other students that I did this with. Not everybody had a porch, but I still called them my porch sessions. You know, a couple of students, I worked right outside their trailer, and again, I brought my camping chair, and they sat up there on their little stoop, and we worked through whatever work they had to do. Sometimes I brought extra things that they wanted to work on. I brought, you know, whiteboards and flashcards and things like that. So we focused on getting the work that was required finished, but then I also tried to use that time to work with them too, just on individual needs that they might have.
You know, I think a lot of us think to our school days and we think, oh my gosh, the teacher's showing up at my house. That would be my worst nightmare. What was your students' reaction when you showed up at their house the first time? Were they happy to see you?
They were so excited. Yes, they really were. And I wasn't really sure. Like I said, I had parent permission to do this, but I hadn't talked to students prior. But showing up and seeing their smiles, they were just so excited. Yes, it may have just been that they hadn't seen people because we were under, you know, quarantined. But no, I do think that they were excited to see their teacher there. And some parents, a couple of them just needed the work. They had like a transportation issue. They couldn't get to school, you know, after those 10 days to get the additional work. So, but they weren't having trouble, you know, at home with their students completing the work. So sometimes I would just go into school and pick up the work and, you know, just drop it off. I know one of my students went to her house and she was out jumping on the trampoline. So I was able to keep my distance and just talk to her. And I didn't have to, you know, make her do any work. I was just dropping it off for her and just having some time to visit. So it was really a great experience to get to see the kids at their houses, because that's not something that we usually take time to do. And like you said, sometimes it's kind of taboo, you know, it's just kind of unusual, but this was a great experience, great learning time to go and meet kids where they are, where they live.
So looking back on those weird weeks since March 13th, what was probably the biggest lesson or the most positive lesson for you as a teacher?
I think the biggest lesson for me ties right into meeting them at their homes. I realized the importance of strengthening those relationships with students and their families. And I think I've always done a good job of that. But this whole experience that we were all, you know, experiencing at the same time, it kind of forced me to talk to my parents more. Our district required us to have at least a weekly contact with parents. And honestly, you know, in the school year, that's not something that we normally do. We don't normally talk to the parents every week. So this kind of pushed us to do that kind of. And then for my own experience, like I said, like I've told you about, I went to many of my student homes, which is something I normally would never have done. So I feel like I really learned, I want to see where my students are coming from, and I want to see those parents and see them in their homes. And I feel like I got to know my students a lot better, seeing and knowing where they were coming from every day.
You know, that's really interesting because we see them in the classroom every day and we think we know people, but we only know them six, eight hours of the day. So I think that's a really good point. So you just recently finished a program at EKU to add a regular education, an elementary certification, to your special education certification. So you're going to be in a fifth grade classroom this fall, right?
Yes, I'm very, very excited. Yes, I had gotten my special education certification through the MAT program several years ago. In the back of my mind, I kind of thought I might, you know, want to go a different direction at some point. So yes, through Eastern Kentucky University, which was an awesome experience, I was able to complete my rank one to add that elementary certification. So I will be teaching fifth grade right now. That we were talking, saying that's going to be math. Of course, we don't really know what the year is going to look like. I've heard several proposals of, you know, maybe the teachers would all be self-contained. So I don't really know exactly what it will look like. But right now, the plan is to teach fifth grade math.
So, and I just want to add that a MAT program is a Master of Arts of Teaching. So that's a master's degree for people to get certified that didn't get certified as an undergraduate. So you're going to be going in sort of a new teaching situation. What's your biggest fear about this new year that's coming up and sort of changing the job a little? So how are you going to tackle that?
Right. Well, through my co-teaching experiences, I feel like I'm ready for teaching math. I had a really strong fifth grade math teacher that I was able to teach with and collaborate with this year. So I know that I'm ready for that challenge of being in the classroom. I know that it will be different. It will definitely look different than my special education experience. But I guess my biggest fear is going to be that we're not able to learn in person. I feel like elementary kids, that's where they thrive. They thrive in that classroom. But they don't thrive on, you know, paper packets of work, which is what we kind of have to lean on for NTI or for tribe work. So I guess that's my biggest fear, is that we won't be in school in person. Online courses work well for us college students, but I don't think that that's the best way for elementary students to learn. So I'm a little bit worried about that. Also, kind of thinking about my special education experience, I had that luxury of having a small group of kids I was working with. My caseload was 15 students. So I was able to go to home. You know, I was able to, like I said, I didn't get to go to every single one. I missed a couple of them, but I was able to go to, you know, a handful of homes to meet those kids. Teaching fifth grade math, my classroom's going to look a lot different. I'm going to have a lot more students, probably about 85 students that I'm going to be responsible for. So I don't think that I'll be able to go to every single home and do those porch sessions if we are, you know, learning long distance.
And you made a really good point. NTI packets, or non-traditional instruction packets, those can work for a short term for snow days, but it's a lot harder when it's a long-term school closure, isn't it?
It really is. And for us, from what I have seen, it worked well to reinforce skills that were learned and to do some review work. But when you're introducing new skills and you're talking about new standards and new learning objectives, it's very difficult to do that through packets or through long distance learning.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.
And I wish you luck with that fifth grade classroom this fall. And hopefully things will be as normal as they can be.
Thank you so much. I hope so, too.
And our thanks to Dr. Cynthia Reeser for that interview with Micah Fawns. We'll also be hearing soon from school superintendents in a series of interviews by Tanya May. Coming up after the break, App Harvest, the company building that huge greenhouse operation near Moorhead, has signed an agreement with companies and universities in Lexington and Eastern Kentucky and in the Netherlands to develop Kentucky's rural Appalachian region as an ag tech hub. We'll hear from App Harvest founder and CEO Jonathan Webb. And
there's not a moment quite like a crisis to really study and see the true national character come to the fore.
No, Tracy Campbell is not referring to today. The UK historian talks with Tom Eblin about his new book, The Year in Peril, America in 1942.
There's this search engine called Google Ngram, where you can look up a term or a phrase or a person's name, how many times it was used in the printed word over the last 200 or 300 years. And in 1942, the word democracy was used in the printed visage more than any other time in America's history because people knew what was on the line.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Governor Andy Beshear says an agri-tech agreement signed last week with 16 organizations, including the government of the Netherlands, could help transform Kentucky's economy. The initiative is rooted in the App Harvest project near Moorhead, where one of the world's largest greenhouses is now being built. Governor Beshear says similar greenhouses will spring up in other parts of the Commonwealth. Our governor does like slogans, and he's come up with one for this project. Let's get growing.
I believe not a year from now, but just a couple months from now, you're going to hear this, let's get growing, in conferences, in boardrooms, all across the United States. We are going to be, because we are committed to be, the leader in agritech, and we are going to get the attention of this nation and of this world.
Governor Beshear says the coronavirus pandemic has driven home the importance of a stable food supply. He sees Kentucky's place in agritech as addressing that issue.
And companies are going to find that we have, for years, had the great types of incentives, of loans, and of grants to truly grow a business. They've just been, in many cases, in different places and not brought to bear for the full life cycle of a business.
App Harvest's 2.7 million square foot farm is scheduled to open this fall and start supplying fresh produce to supermarkets and groceries in the region. And now comes this word of an expansion of this vision. I caught up with App Harvest founder and CEO Jonathan Webb moments before he was to go into a meeting with Governor Beshear at the Capitol. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Tom. Good to catch up again.
And I know you just have a few minutes, so if you would, tell us about this agreement between your company and I think more than a dozen other organizations.
Yeah, Tom, I think when I was last with you, we talked about this ecosystem concept, and what we've tried to do here at App Harvest is really be, you know, a team player and, you know, kind of open up what we're doing to as many parties as possible. And one of those early on was the new administration with Governor Beshear. And we really just kind of laid out, here's what we're working on. Here are the government stakeholders we're working with in the Netherlands. If there's anything we can be helpful in a bigger consortium, let us know. And then today was the announcement of what we've been working on for several months before COVID, and then continued behind the scenes with our team to kind of work on. And we had an agreement signed today with most all of our universities east of Lexington. So the University of Kentucky, Moorhead State University, EKU, UPike, Berea College, a couple universities in the Netherlands, and then seven other companies in the Netherlands And then the Minister of Agriculture over in the Netherlands and Governor Bashir signed it. It's a collaboration agreement that's dedicated towards long-term information sharing between our universities and companies to be able to build out this more robust ecosystem of, frankly, research and talent that's much needed to drive this industry forward. So it's a big step forward, like you said, in the overall vision of what we're going after, and appreciate the commitment of everybody that's been involved. And but now the real work's ahead of us here in the coming years.
And Jonathan, as I understand it, the ultimate aim is to establish Appalachian Kentucky, as something of an ag tech center. Is that right?
That's right, Tom. So I encourage your listeners to look at the National Geographic article, This Tiny Country Feeds the World. It's a great piece that kind of shows what the Netherlands has been able to do. They're a country that's a third the size of Kentucky. You could fit the whole country into eastern Kentucky. And they have the second most agricultural exports in the world, only behind the U.S. So simply what we're trying to do is take that ecosystem that's over there, which is universities, high schools, community colleges, working with private companies and with government support alongside them. They've developed a very robust ecosystem that's able to drive their agriculture economy forward. And we go back to, you know, big picture, that this is a lot more than just App Harvest. We need several other companies involved and many new companies here if we're going to accomplish the objectives that we're all going for, which is, you know, a large-scale fruit and vegetable production here in the U.S. and putting it specifically in the eastern part of our state.
So this agreement that you have entered into with these other partners calls for the establishment of something called a Center for Excellence. And I'm wondering what that will be, what will be its focus. Is it a physical structure? Where might it be located?
Well, Tom, as you know, we've got our facility under construction, and we're going to open up here later this year. And we're at App Harvest going to build more of our facilities. But as we've started to work with our university partners and others, there needs to be a center of excellence that's more about collaboration of research in both plant science and technology. And the World Horti Center in the Netherlands is a bit of an example that we're trying to replicate for our region. We're not sure where we'll put that yet. And I say, you know, we as the collective groups at the table, but there's been a commitment today that we're going to work towards building an R&D facility in our region that's going to be able to continue to further drive this industry. So, you know, we've been very clear. App Harvest has taken no state or federal dollars. We've taken no public money. All of our financing is private sector financing. But long term, as we continue to build our projects and other companies come to the region, we've got to repivot not just ag universities here in Kentucky, but frankly, all across the U.S. And there needs to be new facilities with new research going on where this industry is going. And today was a commitment by all parties that we're going to work towards building this ag tech center of excellence.
The agreement also calls for building additional private infrastructure similar to this huge greenhouse that you're building now near Moorhead. Would the location of these facilities be strategic in some way, logistics, for example, playing a role?
So, Tom, we at App Harvest want to build our facilities in Appalachian counties, and we want to build them in the eastern part of Kentucky. So we're going to try to stay towards universities early on, and that's why we're in Moorhead, with Moorhead State University. But our plan is to continue to build our facilities, and we're going to work to rapidly get this facility online and then build other facilities behind it. So for us, we're going to continue to put our dollars to work and build these facilities in the eastern part of the state. And that's where today's broader collaboration agreement is focused more on the educational piece long term.
App Harvest founder and CEO Jonathan Webb. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Tom.
Tom Eblin, the literary liaison at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, has joined our interviewing team, and he'll be talking with Kentucky authors about their latest works. His first in this ongoing series is with the author of a book that takes us back more than half a century and reminds us in these times of crisis that in many ways we've been here before.
University of Kentucky history professor Tracy Campbell is the author of several fine books, and this new one may be the best yet. The Year of Peril, published by Yale University Press, tells about many largely forgotten aspects of America's most perilous year, 1942. In our rose-colored memory, this was the year Americans put aside their differences and came together to begin fighting World War II. But Campbell's book reminds us that differences of politics, class, and especially race did not go away, and in some cases they were intensified as the nation, already stressed by the Great Depression, saw normal life upended by war. This was a year when America appeared to be losing the war, and efforts to quickly build planes, tanks, and battleships were hampered by fears of inflation and a severe shortage of rubber. While most politicians of both parties supported President Franklin Roosevelt's leadership of war mobilization, many Southern Democrats seemed more adamant about preserving white supremacy than fighting Hitler and Imperial Japan. Tracy is here today to talk with us about the Year of Peril. Dr. Campbell, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Well, so why did you think it was important to write this book now?
Well, when you say now, it took me a little over 11 years of thinking about it and researching and writing. And it started actually in another crisis that I was living through in 2008 with the financial crisis, and thinking, what does society, what does a government, what do a people go through when they go through these kinds of moments of crisis and notions of survival? And so I wrote this mostly at a time in which I wondered if anybody would even care to think about a time of crisis, and thinking about when you wipe the slate clean and what might happen afterwards. And so I finished it, I think, right around the holidays of 2019. I remember writing something about people might not recognize what's going to happen here, with stores saying, don't buy too much, only take what you need. And I thought, who in the world's going to, you know, recognize that period? So it took quite a while, but it was something that I found to be a revealing moment. I think people or organizations, and particularly societies, really are there's not a moment quite like a crisis to really study and see the true national character come to the fore.
Mm-hmm. Well, what surprised you most in your research?
There were a lot of surprises. I think if there was one thing that I wasn't expecting to do, was write about the history of things that didn't happen. But that kind of came about from looking at a war rumor project that the federal government undertook in 1942 to try and understand what they didn't use the term misinformation then, they used the term rumor. But I wanted to try and understand what people were telling each other. And I think the most surprising thing, the government categorized these levels of rumors, that the one that was repeated the most was what the government termed hate rumors, geared toward African Americans, Japanese Americans, along lines of race and ethnicity. And just kind of digging through that and burrowing through that to see the levels of anger and racism, anti-Semitism, just kind of that kind of bigotry was not something I was expecting, at least not in that kind of way.
Well, you're right that it had a pretty big effect on the war effort. So talk a little about bigotry and racism and how that played into some of what happened.
One of the tough things is to look at anything kind of in a vacuum, because there's so many things happening at the same time, whether it's fear of further attack, fear of what might happen with the economy, what happened to local communities. And so let's just say on the West Coast in January and February, there was widespread fear of what might happen, that just kind of like after 9/11, with the notion of when's the next attack going to occur. In 1942, it was just assumed that there would be more and more Japanese attacks on the West Coast and perhaps German attacks on the East Coast. And so by February, that it had reached kind of a fever pitch in the West Coast, enough to cause President Roosevelt to sign the famous Executive Order 9066 that interned enemy alien, mostly Japanese Americans, into internment camps throughout the West, solely on the notion of what they might do. General DeWitt, who was head of the effort in the West Coast, I remember this quote that even though nothing has happened in his mind, that just proved that they're waiting for it to happen. So those kinds of logical leaps were things that were kind of commonplace in those early, really frightful months.
Well, then also in white supremacy, because I remember you mentioned that in terms of the restrictions on Italian Americans were a lot less severe and then were later eased, with Roosevelt kind of making the comment, I guess, that he thought a lot of them were opera singers. The difference between that and how the Japanese were treated?
Well, there were so many more German Americans and Italian Americans. And even though all three groups were involved in Executive Order 9066, the sheer numbers, particularly throughout the country and in cities like New York, say even Louisville or Cincinnati, made interning German Americans or Italian Americans just impossible. And you have to also remember 1942 is an election year. It's not a presidential election, but it's a congressional off-year election, and both parties were trying to position themselves in ways to do well in November. So being seen as the party that might intern German or Italian Americans was something that Roosevelt and the Democrats wanted to avoid. So that's why those restrictions were quickly taken off.
There's a lot about economics in the book, and I think a lot of people don't really think of that in terms of the war. But in addition to raising money by taxes and borrowing, there was a huge issue about trying to prevent inflation. And the guy who was kind of in charge of that was a really colorful character, Leon Henderson, who I don't think many people have ever heard of.
No. To me, Leon Henderson is really one of the unsung heroes of 1942 in the war effort. And besides maybe a few things on Wikipedia, there's not even so much as an article about him. And I hope that I could bring him a little to the surface, because if we could take ourselves back to 1942 right now, anything we bought or sold or a place that we wanted to rent would be determined by Leon Henderson and his office called the Office of Price Administration. So I remember once reading about something called the Biscuit and Pretzel Subcommittee, and the notion of people in Washington determining the prices of pretzels or biscuits. But the whole notion was to keep some kind of containment on the kind of spending that we were undergoing in 1942, which is kind of mind-boggling when you look at what we were doing in 42 and 43, and certainly by 44 as compared to anything before that. It was spending on a scale that we had never even contemplated. Usually that produces ruinous inflation, which, if it had occurred in the 42 or 43 period, would have made everything so much more expensive. It might have produced a kind of domestic chaos that would have made the war effort almost impossible.
Well, in the book's epilogue, you write that, quote, "The political and economic experience of America in 1942 demonstrates the fragile nature of self-government in times of stress. Right now, we're in a pandemic, we've got political polarization and a new groundswell of calls for racial justice. You know, we're kind of a nation in stress again. And what do you think Americans now can learn from the experience of 1942?
Well, I think there's a lot. One, if we don't glamorize 1942, if we understand how we were also ripped apart in a lot of ways racially, then it helps us maybe not, you know, sugarcoat what happened in 1942 as some kind of period we want to recreate. But on the other hand, there was a sense that came from the White House, and it came all the way down, that there was something involved here that was bigger than you or me. It was something huge. It was not just the survival of the country, but it was the survival of democracy, which one of the things I wasn't expecting, there's this search engine called Google Ingram, where you can look up a term or a phrase or a person's name, how many times it was used in the printed word over the last 200 or 300 years. And in 1942, the word democracy was used in the printed visage more than any other time in American history, because people knew what was on the line. We have a lot, you know, on our plate today, and I don't want to make any quick and fast comparisons, because comparing what we're going through today, whether it's a pandemic or racial and social justice, is different from a war. But those kind of raw feelings, I think, need to be taken into account. We need to understand that nothing is certain. Self-government is always a fragile thing, and to not take it for granted and realize that it's really up to us. And one of the things Roosevelt actually did was say, one, people are going to have to do something, whether it's volunteer for the war effort, to be drafted into the military, or work in a defense plant, or maybe just no more than just buying a defense bond. That would be something they could do to help the effort. But he also used the term we don't use very much today, and that is sacrifice, that there is something you might have to give up in the short run or the long run in order to preserve something bigger than ourselves. And, you know, today we're struggling to whether people are even going to wear a mask in public. And in 1942, people knew that they might be shipping off, like my dad did, to serve in the war, where he might be giving the ultimate sacrifice. And so I think those moments, whether it's 1942 or 1968 or the period after the Civil War, are periods that we really need to kind of focus on and think what happened in those moments. Let's not sugarcoat it. Let's look at the evidence and think, what, you know, how does that apply to us today?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Tracy Campbell, the author of The Year of Peril, America in 1942. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
A bad news, maybe good news development if you like your music live. The building that's home to Headliners Music Hall in Louisville has been put up for sale. Stephanie Wolf with member station WFPL has more.
Headliners owners say while the facility is for sale, they hope to keep the business going. The venue has been shuttered since mid-March due to the pandemic, and because they've had to refund tickets for canceled shows, they're losing money. That's according to co-owner Billy Hardison. He says this is an effort to survive the financial hardships brought on by the pandemic. They hope they'll be able to lease the building from whoever buys it if and when they can resume live concerts. I'm Stephanie Wolf in Louisville.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.